This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 110 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Like last week, I'm going to kick off this week's mailbag show with a question that I received a few days ago. I guess you could just consider this a mailbag show without any sort of random intro, but I wanted to talk about this at the top of the show. The email says, in reference to the combine results, you mainly discuss speed score. Is that a more valuable tool than something like Spark? Some of the players you highlighted, like Christian Kirk, look okay in speed score, but struggled on the other workouts. Thanks, JJ. Rob. So I did mention Kirk as someone who I still like as a prospect towards the end of the show on Tuesday, but it's mostly because of what I talked about on that show, and it's that production trumps combine measurables. There's been a lot of talk this week about what matters at the combine and what doesn't. I'm one who thinks the combine can provide useful information when there are outliers. If Saquon Barkley went to the combine and ran a 4.85 40, I think we'd all look at him a little bit differently. But it's obviously not just the drills. We get height and weight measurements that are important, and teams get to see these guys perform in drills, and they get to interview them as well. I mentioned speed score a lot because there's some correlation between speed score and draft slot. It's not that I personally think that a strong 40 tells us that a certain player is really good or really bad. It's that I know that teams care. It's why we always see fast players drop off draft boards higher than we anticipated year after year, like John Ross last season. I'm also a believer that it's pretty difficult to measure the importance of a particular combine drill and how it relates to the NFL. What I mean by that is that you can match a player's speed score, let's say, to his yardage totals at the NFL level, and then see how strong of a correlation there is. And you'll probably not see a strong correlation. There's not going to be a strong correlation between speed score and total yardage at the NFL level. But what that's telling you is that speed score isn't really explaining yardage totals. Are yardage totals the only way to measure success at the NFL level for a wide receiver or a running back? Of course not. So much goes into that. There's a hell of a lot of complexity when you're looking at some sort of output. This is why I'm never here to tell you that analytics will give you all of the answers. Few things are super predictive in football. This is why I love looking at data within the game, though. It's because you're putting pieces together to try and project the future, knowing that there's no magical golden key that will give you all of the answers. I look at every and all measurables at the combine for players. I really look at the outliers and wonder why they exist. But I don't let those measurables, and I'm not talking about height and weight here, I'm talking about results from the drills, but I don't let them completely alter the way that I view a player. That's why I'm still totally fine with Christian Kirk and this not-so-great wide receiver class. So I guess that's the first question for today's show. But there's more, so let's dig in. This first one says, hey JJ, love the podcast. I agree that Saquon Barkley looks like a stud, but how concerned are you if he goes to the Browns? Do you think he'll be limited by a bad offense and poor coaching, like 2016 Todd Gurley? Or is he so great that he can overcome Hugh Jackson? If we're strictly talking fantasy football here, I don't think worried is the right word to describe my feelings towards Barkley potentially being a Cleveland Brown. Because worried means that there's a chance that something devastating happens on Cleveland and not somewhere else. Now, I don't necessarily think that that would be any different than if he went to, say, the Giants. The Browns aren't nearly as bad offensively as people think, too. The offensive line is absolutely fine. They've got good pass catchers if Josh Gordon is in the mix. Really, it's just the quarterback position that's the big question mark. That, and we're not totally sure what Barkley's passing game usage would look like with Duke Johnson there. But my goodness, if they draft Saquon Barkley in the top five and they don't keep him on the field, I will lose my mind. I don't know what's going to happen to Duke Johnson, but Saquon Barkley better be on the field if they take him that high in the draft. But it's true that they need to improve at quarterback in order for Barkley to thrive fully on that team. This is why I really don't understand people selecting Barkley in these early drafts that are going on over some of the proven talent out there. And that's aside from the fact that people are drafting an unknown over the proven talent. I would honestly temper my expectations in year one for Saquon Barkley overall, but that depends on where your expectations currently are. He can finish in RB1 territory, but handing him top half RB1 status when he'll more than likely land on a bad team doesn't seem all that logical. It can happen, but it's not logical. And that's coming from someone who has Barkley as essentially the best running back prospect over the last decade. This next one says, hey JJ, I'm a big fan of your work, especially now that you can dive deeper into topics in the offseason. I'm totally on board with your viewpoint on the on-the-field value of running backs. They are the icing on the cake for an NFL team. You better have your oven, electricity, ingredients, recipe, and batter before you worry about the icing. But my question is about the off-field value of the big-time running back prospects. Do you think there's any possibility that the GMs draft Zeke and Fournette types early because of their marketability? The popularity of the Cowboys had to increase when they drafted Zeke compared to if they drafted a good lineman or defensive back. They have to sell a lot more Fournette jerseys in Jacksonville and get more national TV spotlight and sell more tickets than a less flashy pick. Do you think this is part of the decision-making process at all in the draft, or am I giving them too much credit? Thanks, Danny. Danny, I honestly have no idea if this is part of their decision-making process, but if it is, it's stupid. Because the thing that sells and the thing that will get people interested in a team straight up is winning. The best sports cities in the country will stop going to games if teams are bad. It's not unique to one city or another. All cities do it. And it's only human nature to do that. I have no problem with people not caring to spend money on tickets when their favorite team sucks. But if they're deciding to not be optimal with their drafting because they care more about the marketability of a player over winning, then they'll lose their jobs quickly. That's what happens when you don't win in the NFL unless you're Hugh Jackson, Marvin Lewis, or Jeff Fisher. This next one's from Twitter, @HammerToesNFL. Can you break down what goes into dynasty rankings? Are they based on overall projected points throughout the rest of their career? And if so, why would someone about to retire ever be over a young player, i.e. Larry Fitz over D.D. Westbrook? Or are they based on a new startup? Thanks. Dynasty rankings are essentially there to say, I would rather own this player in a dynasty league right now than this player. How people get to that conclusion will vary because people care about certain things more than others. Some are less interested in age, for instance. But age is still baked into any ranking list that you'll see, or it should be. So when you say, why would someone about to retire ever be over a young player, and then using Fitz and D.D. Westbrook as your example, the answer is that they probably wouldn't if the player you're comparing to is Fitz to D.D. Westbrook. Or at least they shouldn't. It does depend, though. Some teams are in win-now mode, and Fitzgerald has a high chance of outproducing Westbrook this year. If you only think about age, you're bound to get into trouble because, number one, not all young players produce, and then two, not all young players pan out. I think dynasty rankings are fine, just like I think any rankings are fine, but as usual, most need context. That's even more so the case for dynasty rankings versus redraft ones. This next question says, without attaching a value to every individual player, is there a formula for finding value in auction leagues? My league has set rosters, i.e. three quarterbacks are rostered, no more, no less, and I know quarterback auction prices are certainly too high. So if quarterbacks are too high, something else must be low. I don't see that with top-end running backs or wide receivers, though. So it must be somewhere else. I'm guessing that second tier of players. I've been seeking a way to quantify this hunch with data. I'd love to hear your thoughts or processes to determine this. And then he says, we do IDPs, so it could potentially be there, but I can't see it being off by more than a small amount. Thanks, Bo. So I'm pretty sure I know what you're asking here. I'm just going to give you more of a high-level answer because I think it'll be more helpful. As I've said before on the podcast, my approach with drafting is to not be tied down to value charts and rankings. Tiering your players is a much smarter approach with both a snake draft and an auction draft, but it's definitely better for auction drafts because they're not linear. As in, you're not paying the same dollar amount fewer with each pick. In a snake draft, you're going from one pick to the next to the next to the next to the next. You're decreasing by one pick with each selection. What tiering does is that it allows you to play the market and be flexible. When you see a player go for something like $20 and that player is in the same tier as another, then you should feel good about paying about $20 for that other player. But then if you end up getting that player for $10, then all of a sudden you've found value. That's how you're finding value in an auction draft. Because truth be told, every auction draft is different, which is what makes it so fun. It's not that they're drastically different from redraft leagues and that Todd Gurley will all of a sudden be devalued completely, but how people spend will differ greatly, and you have to adjust as the auction goes on. Essentially, what I'm saying here, Bo, is that there's no formula to determine the psychology of your league mates before a draft starts, especially if you're playing with people that you don't usually play with. I think that's sort of what your question is asking here. I would worry less about what a formula says and be more focused on tiering players and being prepared to be reactive to how a draft is going down. This next one says, what's up, JJ? Love the show and your straightforward, no BS fantasy advice. I try to never miss an episode. Was curious about your thoughts on Kenyon Drake going into 2018. He showed some flashes once Ajayi was gone and Damian Williams was injured, but it remains to be seen if Miami will use him as a workhorse. In terms of a dynasty league, should I sell him now before Miami makes another move in their backfield, or hold on to him? Thanks so much, Graham. I'm not the biggest Kenyon Drake fan in the world because he had horrific college production. He's an athletic back, but he averaged just 8.6 attempts per game during his final college season and never hit the 100 attempt mark during his 4 years at Alabama. Regardless of competition, you guys, that's not good. He ranks in the bottom 15th percent in college production among running backs. Really, Drake would be fine fantasy-wise if the team gave him a shot, because volume is really everything when we're looking at the running back position. But there's already been reports that the Dolphins really like Darius Geis, and the Bears and the Dolphins reportedly had some trade talks involving Jordan Howard and Jarvis Landry. So I would be shocked if the Dolphins didn't do something in the draft this year at running back, especially given the class is pretty strong. So I'm totally fine with selling Kenyon Drake right now. This next one came in a couple of weeks ago, but I wasn't able to get to it, but it's still relevant. It says, JJ, first off, I wanted to tell you that I very much appreciate your podcast, your analysis, and the way that you explain it in a way that is easy to digest and understand for the listeners who don't analyze sports-driven data for a living, i.e. myself. Your rationale is very different from most fantasy analysts that I've read or listened to, and in the leagues that I play, your, quote, system is the most efficient way to maximize success, so thank you. Thank you, I really do appreciate that, even though anyone listening right now is rolling their eyes because they really don't care, but it really does mean a lot to me. Anyway, the email goes on. In your mailbag episode from last week, and this was actually 2 weeks ago now, there was a free agency question pertaining to Le'Veon Bell, so that got me thinking about one of my favorite free agents this year in Sammy Watkins. I haven't heard any buzz about him and feel as though he's extremely underrated as both an NFL receiver and a fantasy asset. Last year, he was stuck in an offense that, as I understand it, was extremely simplified for Jared Goff by Sean McVay, and that it was mostly hinged on the running success of Todd Gurley, not to mention he played a murderer's row of lockdown cornerbacks the entire season. I know you're not much into speculation as to where someone will land in free agency, but I was curious how his efficiency rated last year and how you view his overall talent going forward. I'm in several keeper leagues in which I currently own him and would be curious if he would be worth keeping at a reduced auction value if he landed in the right situation. Thanks, Josh. Sammy Watkins is a really interesting player, partially because we've seen flashes of brilliance, but also because the dude just cannot stay on the field. Regarding his 2017 season, I think that we have to remember that Sammy was traded pretty late in training camp in the preseason process, so he didn't have a lot of time with the offense before the season got started. That's important for any player, let alone a wide receiver who's trying to get in a rhythm with his quarterback. Efficiency-wise, Watkins actually looked pretty similar to how he's performed in two of his other three NFL seasons. So I don't think he was necessarily bad, he just didn't see a ton of volume in the offense with just 70 targets. What was interesting about his season was that his average depth of target really wasn't that different than what we've typically seen from him, but his air yards on completed passes was. In 2015 and 2016, Watkins had 14.67 and 14.11 air yards per reception. So that's the number of air yards on a completed pass. 14.67 and 14.11. This past year, that fell to 10.18. So roughly 4 air yards per reception lower than 2016. But his average depth of target, so how far the ball was down the field on each target, was actually higher than what it was in 2016 when he played half the season. What this tells me is that it wasn't so much the fact that the Rams used him in some completely weird way, but rather he wasn't able to haul in the typical deep balls that he's been able to in the past. And the data actually shows that, as he caught about 24% of his deep ball targets last year. He had 21 deep ball targets, whereas he caught about 39% of them the year prior. That 24% catch rate on deep balls was pretty bad within the context of the Rams' offense. Cooper Kupp had a deep ball catch rate of 63%, and Robert Woods was at 47%. And Watkins actually had more deep ball targets than both of those wide receivers. Now, is this a Sammy Watkins isn't talented anymore thing? Maybe, and we know that he's had a nagging foot injury over his career. But you mentioned his atrociously tough cornerback schedule, and I think that, on top of joining the team late, didn't help things at all. I'm not in love with the potential of re-signing with the Rams only because he'll have to compete for volume in an offense that also wants to be fairly balanced. But at the same time, I'm not sure that you'd get a fair enough return if you traded Watkins right now. So that's sort of my take on him. This last one's from Twitter, @AlexMilio. He says, have you begun your hashtag dad bod training? So for those of you who don't know, my wife and I are expecting a little baby girl in late July, and I couldn't be more excited. And I'm excited not because I'm going to be a dad, but because I get to rock a dad bod. I'm kidding. But yes, I'm very ready to be an official dad runner, Alex. I just need to go out and purchase a pair of white New Balances, cut my lawn a couple of times in them to get them covered in grass stains, and I'll be absolutely set. That's the last question, though. Thanks to everyone for listening to today's show. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And if you're on iTunes, do me a solid and leave a rating and review. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at LateRoundQB, and feel free to email me at jj@numberfire.com with any future mailbag questions. Otherwise, everyone, enjoy your weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.